Recently, I had dinner in London with an old friend who was my roommate during our first few years as undergraduates at Harvard. And as one does, we reminisced about those days, and more than once laughed at our younger selves. He teased me about my disastrous first encounter with hard alcohol during Freshers Week, while I in turn reminded him that on the first day we met, he ostentatiously put up a poster of Karl Marx on our common room wall. This is especially amusing in retrospect, not least because 20 years later, he now serves as a vice president for Goldman Sachs. As our conversation progressed, I asked my friend what it's been like to work in the financial sector during these last few years, given the public animus it's received since the economic crisis erupted in late 2008. His response both surprised and intrigued me. The people I work with at Goldman, he said, think it's all incredibly unfair. They're resentful and angry that everyone else is blaming them for what's happened. After all, the economy has to function, and it couldn't if people like us didn't exist. Taking it out on us isn't going to solve anything. Now, as much as what he said that night, it was the tone of my friend's comments that have been troubling me ever since. He, no doubt, like many of those who work in the City of London or on Wall Street, is an educated and informed and thoughtful person. And yet, clearly, there's something very wrong indeed when those who exist at the top of the economic pyramid are so unwilling or unable to understand why they should be held morally accountable for the grave financial problems we now face. Their eagerness to excuse themselves is in itself culpable. For what the crisis has brought into bold relief is not just the failure of the system in practical terms, but also a breakdown in social communication. There's a profound disconnect these days afflicting Western society. Those who enjoy access to political and economic power are speaking a fundamentally different language from those who do not. We no longer seem even to agree on how to talk about our problems, let alone to formulate solutions in which we can all confidently share. Humane concepts such as fairness and stability and quality of life are increasingly crowded out by the rhetoric of the marketplace, such that more and more aspects of our common life are assessed purely in terms of their economic implications. The Bible has been replaced by the balance sheet, and even the room in which you now sit might be deemed a profit-losing venture. Some of this, of course, is inevitable and necessary. Deciding how best to deploy limited material resources is an unavoidable requirement of life. But this is also why the words we use do, after all, matter so very much. For gradually, imperceptibly even, we see how the language we speak can begin to shape and define our values, rather than the other way around. If then we only ever talk about the world in terms of pounds and pence, then eventually that is, in fact, all we will end up caring about. Now, notwithstanding the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement, or the riots that broke out across the UK last summer, there doesn't actually appear to be a widespread appetite for overturning the capitalist system that now predominates. If anything, the choices of countries like China, India, and Brazil suggest the opposite. But here, closer to home, it's obvious that the problem we face is about more than simply fiddling around the edges. decisions are taken, opportunism always trumps principle. When asked to sum up his understanding of the current situation, one middle-aged man recently observed that people don't like being ignored. Over the last 30 years, it's been lots of little things, little jabs and cuts, that combine to make a big thing. This sense that nobody cares what you say. This was the essential message the Archbishop of Canterbury was also seeking to convey last June in the controversial editorial he penned for the New Statesman. In it, he made a plea to the government for better communication. With remarkable speed, he wrote, "We are being committed to radical long-term policies for which no one voted. The anxiety and anger have to do with the feeling that not enough has been exposed to proper public argument." By contrast, he envisioned a, quote, democracy capable of real argument about shared needs and hopes and real generosity. Now, as Dr. William knows all too well, however, the Church itself has often been merely acquiescent in the status quo and appears to many increasingly irrelevant and hopelessly compromised. That the Church has not done more in the wider society to promote and insist upon the language of human worth and communal value is indeed a judgment upon this generation of Christians. Fortunately, people of faith don't have to go very far in order to rediscover the words that reflect these basic values. The prophetic tradition of the Abrahamic faiths, be it Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, is unequivocal on matters of economic justice. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me," announces the prophet, "because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God." What is unambiguous here and throughout Scripture is that God has and always will have a special care for those who are at the bottom of the pile. And it is a non-negotiable obligation of the wealthy and the privileged to address the needs of the poor and the oppressed. But not only that, and as our gospel reading this evening intimates, how we go about doing this is as important as undertaking to do it in the first place. At the most basic level, the story of the rich man and Lazarus would appear simply to be one of just deserts. The poor man suffers in this world, and so he enjoys paradise in the next. Well, for the rich man, the opposite is the case. And as challenging as this idea may be in itself, there's a detail in the narrative I think invites us to dig still deeper. We're informed that Lazarus lies at the rich man's gate, hoping for a few scraps of food from the rich man's table. And what this suggests is a kind of proximity between the two men, a daily opportunity for each to recognize the other as a human being. So it's not just a practical need, but also a social relationship that the rich man is invited to undertake, and that he routinely chooses to ignore. It's really no accident, then, that after his death, hell will take on for him the very shape of what in life he inflicted upon Lazarus. That is, what's described as the great gulf now fixed between paradise and the rich man dramatizes not only physical suffering, but also personal isolation and social exclusion. It's just the sort of chasm many now see opening up in our own society. A chasm into which the principles of human equality and mutuality threatened to be altogether lost. Neither will we be any more justified than the rich man's brethren in claiming after the fact that we didn't know any better. One imagines Father Abraham telling us the same thing that he says in the story. They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. Even as bit players operating within an admittedly massively complex economic system of global interdependence, all of us retain the ability to choose the right words, to frame what matters to us and why. And for those of us who look to Scripture, the words are not hard to understand, however unpalatable the message can sometimes be to us. To ignore those who are in need is sinful. To regard them as something less than fully equal to ourselves, and not to treat them and speak of them accordingly, is sinful. And for those of us who believe in a God who is loving and intimately concerned with the fate of every one of his creatures, there is also the recognition that someday we will be held accountable for what we do and for what we don't do, for the ways in which we value each other and for the ways we do not. In this season of Easter, we have once again been offered a vision of God's determination to save us from our own worst selves and to give us another way of living in the world. The economic problems we face now are not unprecedented, but neither can we be certain where they are taking us. But what does lie within our grasp is to use words that bring us closer together rather than drive us further apart. What does lie within our grasp is the ability to assume responsibility, not only for our own personal good fortune, but also for that of the wider community of which we are inevitably a part. And out of the right words and out of the right assumption, we may yet proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord.